And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Turkey has followed through on its promise to invade northern Syria. The move comes after President Trump's sudden and controversial decision on Sunday to withdraw U.S. troops from the area. By removing the troops, President Trump effectively cleared the way for neighboring Turkey to advance into the area, commandeer miles of land potentially, and possibly kill off the Kurdish forces there that have helped the U.S. to neutralize ISIS in Syria. The decision could also create room for ISIS to regroup and expand. What will this decision mean for an already volatile area, and how will it affect U.S. credibility in the region and around the world? To help unpack all of that, we'll hear from a couple of experts who know the area well. Villanova Professor Samer Abu joins us, along with Professor Brendan O'Leary from the University of Pennsylvania. But we begin in the Middle East with Liz Sly, who covers the region as the Beirut bureau chief for The Washington Post. Liz has spent the better part of 30 years as a foreign correspondent covering the Middle East, Africa, China, South Asia, and Europe, and she joins us now from Beirut. Liz Sly, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
So, and thank you for being with us in the midst of everything that is happening in northern Syria right now. What is going on there on the ground as far as you know?
Well, what we know is that President Erdogan of Turkey has announced the launch of the military offensive against northeast Syria and against the U.S. allied Kurds there. There has not actually been an invasion yet. No troops have crossed the border. There have been some a small number of airstrikes against three villages southeast of a town called Ras Al Ain, and there has been some shelling on a town called Tal Abyad. This was the area where the offensive was widely expected to take place and from which around 50 U.S. troops withdrew a couple of days ago. But so far, no troops crossed the border.
And how are the Kurdish forces responding at this point?
At the moment, they haven't responded. They don't have anti-aircraft. It's only been airstrikes. They're saying they will stand their ground and fight, but there hasn't actually been any confrontation yet.
They certainly have threatened, though, Liz, they have said, you know, we will defend ourselves if and when this begins.
Yes, the Kurds aren't any match for Turkey's NATO army with its armored vehicles and troops. But they have in the past waged a successful guerrilla insurgency inside Turkey, a group affiliated to this Kurdish group. And I think it's widely expected that while they couldn't hold off a Turkish invasion, this could become the beginning of a long, insurgency against the Turks if they go in.
Well, and you've touched on something that people have been talking about for the last several days and the major concern that's been raised that, in fact, the Kurdish forces are no match for the Turkish military and that this could end very, very badly for them.
Well, if they were to get out of the way of the Turkish forces, it's unclear what would happen. What we saw in a place called Afrin, which is a Kurdish enclave in northwestern Syria, the Turks overtook that last year. And there was some pretty fierce fighting, but it didn't take the Turks very long to do it. This is a much larger area overall that they are targeting. So it really remains to be seen how far the Turks want to go, how deep they're prepared to go, and whether the Kurds decide to try and put up a full front fight or whether they decide to, like, melt away and do guerrilla attacks, which is their specialty.
There were some reports, Liz, that the Turkish government might carry out this invasion, this incursion in stages and sort of use it as leverage with the United States, that they would sort of do it incrementally and try to go back to the United States and negotiate. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, yes, I think nobody is expecting, and it would be very surprising if there was some huge, massive Turkish invasion of the whole of this very large area. Which is why we are expecting the offensive to concentrate on these two towns, about 80 miles apart. In between, there's a string of fairly unpopulated villages, still a lot of them quite depopulated since the Islamic State war. So we aren't at the moment talking about some massive onslaught into this region, as far as we can tell. Yes, and then they are likely to say, oh, yes, look, we did it. We're here. We'll go further unless this and this. And remember, there are other players in this conflict, too, other players in the region. And Erdogan and Putin held a telephone call today. And Russia has called for the YPG and the Syrian Kurds and the SDF to open a dialogue with the regime. The Turks have said they are open to that. So it could be that we start seeing Russia play a bigger role in the diplomacy in this area. And it's Russia who starts exerting the leverage.
Is there reason to believe that those talks could take place?
I think that the Syrian Kurds have made it very clear they would like the regime to talk to them. The regime has made it clear it will talk to the Syrian Kurds on one condition only, which is basically surrender, the same condition that they've put to rebels in the rest of the country. I think this is why the SDF is quite hopeful that the Russians could get involved and perhaps offer them some kind of protection and perhaps mediate with Turkey. But this is all very early stages. We've just seen, we're in the first hour of this incursion, and we're a few hours away from that phone call. So there are a lot of moving parts here.
Well, you've also touched on another fear, which is that Russia and Iran could step into a perceived vacuum left by the United States there.
Yes, and this is indeed also highly likely. The Syrian government has troops just to the south of the area where the U.S. troops are, to the south and to the west. And they've made no secret of the fact that they want to recover the entire area the U.S. is in. And so we could see a situation where the Kurds are fighting the Turks to the north, and the Syrian government with its Iranian allies and Russian allies step up to try and snatch some land from the south.
Well, and then that raises the question of ISIS, because we know that the Kurdish forces have been guarding ISIS fighters in prisons over there, tens of thousands of them, and the concern about the Kurdish forces now abandoning those posts to defend themselves to the north and to the south.
Yes, it's highly likely that ISIS would take advantage of any security vacuum, any reduction in the number of the guards at the prison, any fighting that took place in the vicinity of those prisons or those camps, to try and stage a breakout, to try and activate secret cells to rescue the people in those prisons. And so that adds another huge layer of volatility. I personally don't believe the Kurds will release the ISIS prisoners. The first people those fighters would encounter are Kurdish communities, Kurdish families, and they would be the ones to suffer from it. I think they will keep guarding them. But the message they're basically trying to send is, look, we are guarding these people for you. You won't take them back. Take them back or come and help us.
There were reports of early morning attacks by ISIS in Raqqa today. Liz, what have you heard about that?
Yes, there was about an hour or two long gun battle in the middle of the night. It's about 2 a.m. The SDF said 3 suicide bombs were set off and that the ISIS apparently tried to attack a military post. ISIS has claimed that it only set one suicide bomb off. The Kurds could be panicking a little bit here. They could be kind of overstating the risk. Although there was a lot of gunfire, apart from, it seems, one SDF person was killed, apart from that, it doesn't seem to have been a very major attack. I think this is quite a test of ISIS's ability to come back as well. If there is such a security vacuum, if there is a huge battle, and there is chaos in the area, ISIS will obviously try and take an advantage of that. And then we'll get a sort of sense of how much support they do have in the area and in what sort of shape they are.
Liz, can you tell us a little bit about what is happening in those camps? I was reading some of the work that you have done around that, as well as some of your colleagues. And I don't know that most of us have a good sense of what life is like in those camps and the issues that are going on there.
Well, the big issue is this camp called Al-Hol, where there were around 70,000 people. Over half of them are children, 65% of them are children. The rest are mostly women. There aren't any fighters in the camp. The fighters are held separately in prisons scattered around the northeastern area. The camp itself is a huge concern because it's very big. It's very lightly guarded. And although a majority of those residents are children and families, and many of them people who were just displaced by the war and just want to get out and go back to their lives, the Kurds don't have a mechanism for screening those people because they're so stretched. They don't know which ones are extremists and which ones aren't. And the ones who are extremists, who include several thousand foreigners, have been kind of taking over the camp within the perimeters of it, imposing their harsh laws on the population. They've inflicted punishments that have killed some of the women. And the Kurds are very, very worried that this camp could actually fall under ISIS control.
I was reading some of those stories about violence, about certain women even in the camps who are threatening, torturing, firing shots even at those who do not buy into their ideology.
Yes, that's right. You've got a very fearsome, fearful situation for all the people who are living in the camp because the ISIS women are imposing their rule. They hold these courts. They hold Sharia courts in which they impose their version of the Islamic laws and try and subjugate people who don't want to abide by them. And when the Kurdish guards, who are really outnumbered by this huge camp, I mean, 70,000 is a substantial size city. This is people living behind a fence in tents. And when the Kurdish guards go and try and break these things up, the women throw stones at them, hails of stones, and on one occasion last week, they pulled guns on them, and the Kurds are worried that they're somehow smuggling in weapons from outside.
Liz, can you talk about the price that the Kurdish forces have already paid in this conflict in helping the United States in Syria?
Yes, they paid a huge price. Since 2014, they've been allied with the U.S. against ISIS. They've received a lot of military help from that. And they've also gained a lot of political advantage because they've gained control over a huge part of Syria, most of which actually isn't Kurdish at all. But ISIS was there and they were running it and the Kurds got rid of them with the United States. But at the same time, they've also sacrificed very heavily. 11 to 12,000 of them have been killed. Tens of thousands have been injured. And for that reason alone, the Kurds feel they're entitled to a little bit more support from the United States now that the post-war situation is getting so messy.
How many are left? Do we have any sense of that?
Of the number of Kurdish fighters?
Yes.
Well, we don't know the exact number of Kurdish fighters. The SDF is a coalition of Arab and Kurdish fighters. They put the number at around 50,000. I think it's probably a bit smaller. The Kurds, however, and their militia, the YPG, which is allied to the PKK in Turkey, which is regarded as a terrorist organization by Turkey, hence the problem, undeniably dominates the SDF and controls the SDF, giving it a very Kurdish flavor.
Liz Sly, we want to thank you so much for taking the time in the midst of all of this breaking news to join us, to help us to understand what is happening there on the ground. We so appreciate your great reporting on this. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
There is much more to discuss about what is happening in northern Syria. We'll be talking with a pair of experts about that, and we'll welcome your questions and comments as well when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. If you are just joining us, we're talking about President Trump's decision to draw down American troops from northern Syria. The move effectively cleared the way for neighboring Turkey to begin to carry out the military incursion into the area that it had been threatening for some time. And in a limited way, that incursion got underway this morning. That is, of course, the worst possible news for the Kurdish forces that have been instrumental in helping the U.S. neutralize ISIS in Syria. Turkey views those Kurdish forces as terrorists and a threat to national security. Turkey also wants to resettle about a million Syrian refugees into the area, which could create a whole new set of problems. What is likely to happen there, and what will President Trump's decision mean for the Kurds, for the Middle East, and for U.S. foreign policy? And how is it affecting U.S. credibility in the region and around the world? To help us get a handle on why this is so important, we turn to a pair of experts on the region. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of Global Interdisciplinary Studies at Villanova University and an expert on Syria. Brendan O'Leary is the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He has also served as a political and constitutional advisor to the United Nations, the European Union, and the Kurdistan Regional Government of Iraq, and he's the author of a number of books, including a new three-volume study called A Treatise on Northern Ireland. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
So, Brendan O'Leary, let's start with you. I think it would be useful to backtrack a little bit so that we can understand who all the players are and what exactly is the genesis of all of this. So who are the major players and what are the dynamics that are at play in that region?
So the Kurds are the largest ethnic group on earth without a state of their own. The Kurds are divided across four countries: Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. The Kurds call these the four wolves, indicating how the Kurds feel about the disposition of each of those states towards Kurds. The Kurds of Syria are, by and large, closest in dialect and in ethnicity to the Kurds of Turkey. And as your correspondent from Beirut was saying, there are strong and indeed direct linkages between the Syrian Kurdish military organizations and those of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, in Turkey. So that's the Kurds. The other players, and there are lots of them in the game, include Iran, which is backing the beleaguered, until recently, regime of Assad in Syria, a regime which has waded through blood to maintain itself in power. It's opposing a Syrian, largely Arab and Muslim, and largely now Islamist opposition. And the Assad regime is supported, by and large, by Russia and by Iran. In the north of Syria, we have an area, northeast of Syria, we have an area which the Kurds call Rojava. But the area currently administered by Kurdish forces or Kurdish-led forces encompasses roughly 30% of Syrian soil. And in the southern part of that area, most of the population is Sunni Arab. And most of those Sunni Arabs opposed ISIS along with the Kurds and made at least a temporary alliance against ISIS with them. That's probably going to break down now.
So there are a number of players and a complex set of interests in that part of the
indeed.
World right
and
now.
And Turkey historically claims lots of the territory in northern Syria and previously has captured and annexed territory that formerly belonged to Syria. So Turkey has form in this area. Turkey is arguably a repeat genocidal offender. The primary function of the Turkish army, I think, has accurately been described as one scholar has put it, to repress Kurdish insurgencies. So the Turks for a long time have demanded a safe space in northern Syria. We should be entirely suspicious about this. Their prime goal is to clear an area of northern Syria, to clear the Kurdish population and Kurdish forces out of there, and to settle it with Sunni Arabs who have been displaced from conflict elsewhere in Syria, many of whom do not belong to the region. And the advantage of this from a Turkish strategic point of view is that it would split any territorial connection between the Kurds of Syria and the Kurds of Turkey, and it would place a dependent clientelistic population that would rely on Turkish support and would be hostile to the regime in Damascus.
So that opens up a whole new set of problems.
It does. And we're only just beginning.
And we're only just getting started. Samer Aboud, let me ask you a bit more about why the Turkish government views the Kurds as terrorists.
Yeah, I think Brendan and Liz alluded to this, that the political, social, ideological connections with the PKK is really what establishes the connection for the Turkish government there. I think that they see the leadership of the PKK and the PYD as inseparable. And if you go and see the Syrian Kurdish areas in the northeast, There is the imagery, the PKK imagery, PKK slogans. There's a lot to suggest that there is a very deep connection between the two parties. That does not mean that the PYD does not have interests or goals or strategies independent of the PKK, but what it does mean is that it's a very convenient link. There is a convenient and obvious link between the PKK and the PYD, which renders them as part of the PKK as an appendage. Yeah.
And yet the United States is sort of caught between these two, because Turkey is a NATO ally of ours, and the Kurdish forces have been instrumental in helping us in that part of the world.
Absolutely. But I think that for those of us who have been watching what's happening in Syria since 2011, and especially around 2014 when this temporary alliance between the SDF and the U.S. emerged, I think that it was what we're seeing today was inevitable in a way. It's not clear to me why any of us would think that the U.S. would maintain a long-term alliance with the Syrian Kurds. The alliance was very temporary. The U.S. strategic interests in Syria were very isolated to the question of ISIS. They had no interest in regime change, no interest in fundamentally challenging the Russian or Iranian presence on the battlefield, contrary to what they say. And I think now that we've seen the degradation of ISIS, that the alliance with Turkey has become, I mean, the importance of the alliance with Turkey has now taken precedence over any temporary alliance with the SDF. I think it's also important to note that the Turkish incursion, or what's happening on the Syrian battlefield now, is not happening independent of consensus, a tripartite consensus between Turkey, Iran, and Russia. I think that there was a kind of hold. They were waiting for the American green light, and they received that recently. And I believe that there's also consensus between those three countries for the incursion.
Well, and there was that phone call we heard about this morning between President Erdogan and President Putin when things got underway.
Absolutely. And I think since 2016, there have been these official rounds. They call them the Astana process, the Astana talks. They've changed their name now, I think. But really, this is a way that the three countries have managed the Syrian battlefield. The talks take place based on what's happening in the country. There are informal agreements about how to approach Idlib, how to approach questions of, obviously in the northeast, and other battlefield questions, whether it's in the south, the north, Damascus, and so on. And I think that there had to have been consensus for this to happen, or at least agreement. And I think part of the evidence for that is that the Turkish government did not put up any military opposition, did not really challenge the Russian-led intervention into Idlib to decimate the armed groups there.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Let me take a moment to invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call us at 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Brendan O'Leary, even if it is true that it's not necessarily a surprise that the U.S. Involvement there was deemed temporary, that we weren't committed to being there for the long haul, what message is this sending to the Kurdish forces?
It sends a very clear message to the world that it's better to be America's enemy than America's friend, as they used to say of the British. It's behaved like an imperial power. It's exploited the Kurds to defeat ISIS and then washed its hands of them. Unlike Samar, I don't necessarily see some grand pursuit of a strategic objective by the U.S. here, deferring to the Turkish ally. I see a chaotic decision by a chaotic president, which is deeply resisted both inside his National Security Council and inside both houses of Congress. So although you could make an argument, as Samar did, suggesting that this is part of the U.S. deferring to its alleged good ally, Turkey, I think it's better to see this as a chaotic decision of a rather ill-considered president. Now, when we look back on this, it will obviously depend what the eventual outcomes are. But when we look back on it, America will have betrayed its ally. What we may see, Samar suggests that there is already collusion between Iran, Turkey, and Russia on this. I don't see that. I think both Iran and Russia have been taken by surprise. And Russia will have to make sure that it looks like a good ally of the Assad regime. And that means it's very happy to see the Assad regime roll up Kurdish control over the southern part of Syria. It will have no problem with that. But for the Assad regime, preserving the whole of Syria's territorial integrity will be part of its objective. So it will want Turkish forces out of Syria completely. And the best way for it to accomplish that would be to have the support of the Russian Air Force in protecting Syria's territorial integrity. As for Iran, Iran is obviously not strongly in favor of the Kurds of Syria, who are secular, democratic, feminist, in disposition, formal disposition, even if their practice isn't perfect. But Iran also wants to preserve the Assad regime in power, and it doesn't want to see Turkey making significant gains. So I would expect Iran to do its typical thing and to play a double game and to provide some support for the Kurds of Syria if they switch to playing a guerrilla warfare strategy. One last thing. If we look at what was happening before these events transpired, number one, the US had encouraged the Kurds of Syria to remove fortifications on the border with Turkey as a confidence-building exercise. Once that was completed, then President Trump surrendered to President Erdogan's demand that he be able to invade Syria. That's remarkable. You engage in confidence building and then you betray the organization. The second point to observe is before this occurred, the Russians were encouraging the Kurds of Syria to engage in negotiations with the regime on the basis of autonomy. Now, obviously, that autonomy could only be confined to Kurdish majority areas. It could not extend to the entirety of the areas currently controlled by the Kurds. It's very likely that the Kurds of Syria, pressed between a rock and a hard place, will seek to negotiate with the regime. The regime will say, you have to accept our local government law. The Kurds of Syria will say, no, we'd prefer a more extensive form of autonomy. And basically, I think Russia will be the arbiter of what happens there. So the United States, in effect, has withdrawn and left Russia and Iran as the primary determiners of what will be the final outcome.
Samer, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that and, sure. and add your thoughts before we move on.
Yes. I think I'm not quite sure why any of us believe that the alliance between the United States and the SDF was anything other than temporary or that it was determined by anything other than what was happening on the battlefield. The political project of the PYD expressed through Rojava and then the Democratic Federation for Northern Syria received, to my knowledge, virtually no American support. I don't see any evidence of American political support at the United Nations or in other forms for Syrian Kurdish political aspirations. So again, I'm not sure why we have this assumption that there's kind of comprehensive alliance that could withstand Turkish demands for intervention. I think another point worth making is that the continuum of political possibility, the range of possibilities for Syrian Kurds from 2011 until now has really shrunk. And I'm not sure that we're in a moment where the PYD could negotiate an agreement with the Syrian regime, because I think that the regime has always seen the PYD and Kurdish political aspirations through this kind of zero-sum lens. And there have been lots of opportunities to negotiate in 2013, certainly in 2015 after the Russian intervention. And I just don't see any negotiation where the laws or the practices or the norms of the Democratic Federation for Northern Syria get absorbed into a new Syrian constitution. I don't see any of that. And I certainly believe that the regime officials are not willing to concede anything politically. And I think in that, there's a lot of coherence between the regime and Turkish interests in relation to the Syrian Kurds. Mm.
I was struck by an article that I read yesterday that President Trump's decision set off alarm bells in Israel. The country's biggest newspaper ran an editorial saying effectively that if President Trump could betray the Kurds, what's to stop him from turning on Israel? How significant is it, Semmer, that Israel is now joining the chorus of disapproval about this decision, joining even voices among the Republican leadership in Congress about this decision?
I think Brendan has something really interesting to say about this, so I'll defer to him after my point. I think that there are two very different relationships that we're speaking about here. In the United States, there is significant support for the alliance with Israel. There are deep economic connections, deep military connections, deep cultural connections as well that make the unraveling of that alliance very difficult. I simply don't think that existed between the U.S. and the SDF.
Brendan?
So I think that Samar is right in one sense. There's not a natural alliance between Kurdish Marxists in northern Syria and the Pentagon. But there is a natural alliance between both of them and hostility towards Islamists. And the major strategic rethink that is occurring and I think will continue to occur inside the U.S. is whether Turkey is in fact a long-run ally. President Erdogan is an Islamist. President Erdogan's democratic credentials more or less self-shred by the day. And the government of Turkey regularly allowed ISIS foreign fighters across the border into Turkey, into Syria. At the same time, the refugees from Syria were weaponized by the Turkish government against Europe. So the European Union ended up paying large funds to Turkey in order to house the refugees from the civil war, partly a byproduct of Turkey's own intervention. So that has absolutely destroyed Turkey's standing in most of the European and Atlantic democracies. And that's one long-run factor here that needs to be borne in mind.
Much more to talk about as we consider what is happening in northern Syria, Turkey's the beginning of its planned incursion into northern Syria. Much more to talk about when Radio Times comes right back. Welcome.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. And we are talking about what is happening in northern Syria. As you may know, President Trump made the decision on Sunday, very suddenly, to withdraw American troops from Syria's northern border. And Turkey had been threatening an incursion into that area to create what it calls a safe zone and ultimately to repatriate something like a million refugees in that area. That has created many problems for the Kurdish forces who have fought alongside the United States in neutralizing ISIS in Syria. And so we received word today that that incursion has begun, at least in small measure, from Turkey into the area of northern Syria. And so we've all been watching that story. Our guests are Samer Aboud. He is Associate Professor of Global Interdisciplinary Studies at Villanova University and author of the book Syria. Brendan O'Leary is Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. When we left off, we were talking about Israel and Israel sounding alarm bells and saying that if President Trump could abandon the Kurds, why not abandon us as well, and sort of joining the chorus of voices, even here in the United States among Republican leadership, about the wisdom or lack thereof of President Trump's decision. And Brendan O'Leary, you were talking about that when we left off.
There's two angles here, Tracy. One is the reaction in Israel itself. I think Israeli analysts are quite rightly coming to the conclusion that if you ask the question who benefits in the broader region, the answer is the Assad regime and, in addition, Iran. And in the long run, of course, that poses strategic problems for Israel. The second development, which took me completely by surprise, is that there is a report in Newsweek from a national security official who appears to have been in on the conversation between Erdogan and Trump. And that person is quoted in Newsweek as saying, it would be better for the US if there were to be a Kurdish nation, like Israel, a second Israel in the region. That's astonishing to me because it's been a settled assumption among most analysts that the US does not believe in creating an independent Kurdistan. And for somebody to believe that in the aftermath of a double betrayal, because we need to recall that in 2017, the US simply didn't assist and arguably actively helped the Iraqi government repress the possibility of independence among the Kurds of Iraq, and has now followed this up with betraying the Kurds of Syria. So I think the way that person is reflecting is deeply revealing. Of course, it's too late. I mean, the possibility of supporting the Kurds of Iraq and the supporting the Kurds of Syria probably has gone for now. But it indicates to me the level of fear and anxiety among the people who are advising the Trump administration. They know this is a blunder.
Let me invite our listeners to join us in our conversation. You can call 888-477-9499, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Samer Aboud, why do you think it is that President Trump has been so willing to appease President Erdogan? Because from what we understand, in each of the cases where he made the decision to withdraw troops, and the last time he made the decision, he reversed course. But in each case, it came after a phone call with President Erdogan. Mm. Why is he so easily swayed?
That's a really great question. I wish I had a good answer to it. But I think that he, unfortunately, what we're seeing is he's very impulsive. And he makes these decisions based on conversations where he's clearly persuaded of something. He makes the decisions without reference to the people around him, the intelligence community, the people who might know the situation better than he does. And there's something interesting where I see him reverting to campaign promises. You know, he suddenly adopted this language of ending the endless wars and whatever. But nothing in the decision rolls back the American military presence in Syria. So he's actually not doing anything to end the endless wars that he is, so concerned about, apparently. It's clear his decision-making style is impulsive, and anything that we thought prior to his administration about how foreign policy decisions are made is completely out the window. And really what seems to matter now is getting his ear.
There is a tweet from Ivanka Trump from 2012 that has resurfaced in recent days that says something to the effect of, "Thank you, President Erdogan, for supporting the opening of Trump Tower, Istanbul," which raises the question, is it possible that the president's business interests in Turkey may play some role in his decision making around what happens there? And I would put that to either one of you.
Unfortunately, we can't exclude that as a possibility, given the president's track record. Some people praise President Trump as transactional, a person who can make bargains. The obvious bargain he would have made if he was a realist would have been to say to President Erdogan, "You just bought Russian weaponry, thereby violating a well-established NATO practice. I want assurances from you that you will not be buying any further Russian weaponry and you'll only be buying U.S. weaponry." As far as we know, that quid pro quo didn't happen. So the idea that this is a president skilled at hard bargaining and realistic negotiation is nonsense. This is, as some are suggested, I think correctly, an impulsive decision. I would like to rule out the possibility that he wasn't thinking about Trump Tower, but I can't, because he's not divested himself of his interests. Mm-hmm. And there's a good reason why presidents should divest themselves of their interests while in office, so that nobody can raise these questions.
Samer, we've been talking about the repatriation of refugees as part of what Turkey plans to do by, you know, taking over these 30 miles, and I think 30 miles deep, 300 wide, something like that. Help us understand what that means. If Turkey were to do that and place those refugees in that area, what are the implications of that?
That's a great question. For many years now, especially after 2013, when there was the first large wave of refugees that came to Turkey, there was discussion, actually very early in the conflict. The Turkish foreign minister, I believe, said that if we have more than 50,000 Syrian refugees, we're going to create a safe zone. So this has been on offer. It's been discussed by the Turkish leadership for many years now. And the idea was to go in and to create a buffer zone where refugees could stay rather than crossing the border into Turkey. And now, because there are millions of Syrian refugees who are in Turkey, that has changed. The safe zone is no longer really an option, and they've moved their thinking towards this kind of settlement zones of creating areas where people could be resettled. And that is happening in parallel to forced returns of Syrians in Turkey now. It's happening in Lebanon as well. I believe it's also happening in Jordan, but many of these countries that have been hosting refugee populations are now forcing many people to return. We hear in Turkey of people essentially kidnapped at night and deported back to Syria. These are not orderly deportations. They are very violent. They are against the will of many of the people. There is, of course, some people who are willfully returning, but I think that there is an internal pressure from within Turkey to deport many Syrians.
And then there are concerns that this would create a humanitarian crisis if that happens. Explain that.
Yeah, there is a serious problem with access today. We mentioned, Liz mentioned Al-Hul, there's Ra'ban, there are many other areas that are not completely under regime control. And now what we know, a lot of the evidence is suggesting that the regime has been very masterful at directing humanitarian aid to areas that it wants while depriving other areas. So there is a serious issue of humanitarian access. I imagine that an area in northeastern Syria that is surrounded by the Turkish military will have similar issues of access. So there's really no there's no way that solution meets the humanitarian needs of the population there, or of course any deported population.
Question here from one of our listeners, from Avi, who says, to what extent has the internal split among the Kurds affected their current condition?
The Kurds have always been divided, both by dialect, by tribe, and by party. Inside the Kurds of Syria, it's clear that the YPD, the YPG are dominant, but there are Kurds in Syria who would prefer to be represented by a different style of organization. So their internal divisions matter. But it has to be remembered that the predicament of being a Kurd is that whichever state you're in, whether it's Syria, Turkey, Iran, or Iraq, you have to look for alliances wherever they are. And what tends to happen is that foreign powers pick certain Kurds as their allies and then dump them when it seems appropriate. Mm-hmm. And if necessary, they encourage intra-Kurdish rivalries. So the Kurds have a lot of responsibility for their own internal divisions, but that too is not simply within their control.
If
I could go back to the humanitarian thing briefly.
Sure.
One of the things we have to remember is that Turkey invaded Afrin, one of the three Kurdish-majority cantons in northern Syria. It took it relatively easily, but that led to the expulsion of 160,000 Kurds. I think that's almost certainly a precedent for what may occur now in the Kobani area and in Qamishli. So we know that the absolute maximum size of the Kurdish population in Syria is about 2 million. Its probable size is somewhere about 1,200,000, somewhere thereabouts. A lot of that population was in Damascus and other Syrian cities, but there would be a significant population in the north. So we can expect, unfortunately, that a large number of the Kurds of Syria will be expelled or go in flight in fear of the Turkish army into the Kurdistan region of Iraq, which hosts the largest number of IDPs from the conflict inside Iraq and is already heavily burdened with refugees. So there is no easy option here for foreign policymakers and for the United States. The idea that you can cleanly end all these wars without producing these disastrous humanitarian consequences as the unintended consequence of ill-considered policy is an illusion.
Yeah. I want to ask about ISIS and about the prisons. And my understanding is that ISIS fighters are being held in various places around the country, as Liz Sly told us earlier, in old schools and government buildings, that sort of thing. And President Trump has said that Turkey has assured him that it will manage those prisons as it moves further and further into Syria. Is it realistic to believe that Turkey has the bandwidth to do that, in addition to everything else that it's attempting to do in that region?
So I think the real fear people will have is that Turkish intelligence has frequently used Islamists in the region for the purposes of Turkish national security policy. That's the record. That's not disputed by any Western intelligence agency that I know of. So the idea that President Trump articulated that Turkey can take care of them is in fact an extraordinarily dangerous one. Imagine that they do get control of the camp. The most likely thing is that its intelligence operatives will use certain of these Islamists for future operations. So I wouldn't trust Turkey with those prisoners. I'm pleased that the Kurds of Syria do not appear to be using them as hostages for support from elsewhere. But I think their predicament is genuine. They don't want to release them. They also don't want to waste the few precious resources they have on keeping them in prison. So I suspect the more likely outcome is that the Kurds will hand them over to the regime, which is not likely to deal with them in a generous manner.
I want to ask about the Christians in that area. President Trump certainly has enjoyed strong support here from white evangelical Christians. The question has been raised, what about the Christians who are now in harm's way in northern Syria? And is there some have been raising the question, is there danger of a modern-day Armenian genocide like the one that happened after World War I?
That's a good question, because I think it's difficult, however, to disentangle Syrian Christian interests or their insecurity as a collective from that of their neighbors. I think that what many people in the north are experiencing is not necessarily because of their religious identity or their status. That said, there was a significant amount of persecution, of fear when ISIS had established itself in the northeast, and Syrian Christians, like many other Syrians, have been forced to flee because they're concerned about persecution. They're concerned about their livelihoods. And what we've seen is a lot of people moving into the cities, not just to other countries, but moving into other parts of Syria. I hate to say it, but I'm skeptical of this kind of temporary interest in the plight of Syrian Christians, because I'm not sure how to disentangle their interests and their fears from that of other Syrians.
Yeah. I would put it slightly differently. If you go back to the beginning of the Arab Spring in 2011, there was very, very extensive opposition to the Assad regime. And the Syrian opposition at that time numbered significant numbers of Democrats, people who wanted to reconstruct Syria. But they had no policies towards the minorities, whether they were Kurds, Druze, or Christians. And one simple way of interpreting what's happened during the civil war, and I think it's an accurate one, is that the regime has successfully either got all the minorities on its side or more frightened of the opposition than they are of the regime. Mm. So the Christians, by and large, are now in effect de facto pro-regime, which is a remarkable statement about the fear that they have of Islamists. And they certainly don't look upon Turkey as a successful protector of their long-run interests. Mm.
so much that we have discussed today, and yet there is so much more that we could talk about. We are just about out of time, but let me take a moment to thank both of you. We've been talking with Samer Abood, Associate Professor of Global Interdisciplinary Studies at Villanova. Brendan O'Leary is the Lauder Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane, and you have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY.